Welcome to Tomorrow's People, the podcast brought to you by Personio and me, Perry Timms. Everything starts with people. Someone who has a really unique perspective on people and particularly leadership is the renowned author, speaker and expert, Margaret Heffernan. I was slightly in awe of this conversation, and I'm sure when you watch it, you'll see why. Margaret has a terrific view on the challenges for leaders in changing and turbulent times. Welcome, Margaret Heffernan, to Tomorrow's People podcast. It is such a pleasure to have you here. I'll start with what kind of things are really capturing your attention at the moment and that you're working on with clients and advising people on. Is there anything in specific terms around that that you're finding yourself sort of captured by?
Yeah, I think one of the key issues for me is, and has been, you know, ever since my book Uncharted came out, is how organizations and the individuals leading them are coming to terms with the fact that they're less and less able to run things the way they used to.
Yeah.
So how did they used to do things? Ever since the Industrial Revolution, really, management has been a process of forecasting what do we think demand's going to be, yeah, planning to meet that demand or accelerate that demand, and execution.
Yeah.
And that has worked pretty well for about 200 years since, but it isn't working very well now.
Yeah.
And it isn't working very well now because our ability to forecast has really fallen apart.
Yeah.
Nobody thought there would be a European war, yeah, at this time. We know climate change is real, but we don't quite know how it's going to behave, yep, when and where there are going to be floods or forest fires and so on. Nobody particularly saw a recession coming. Nobody saw inflation coming back.
Yeah.
And these are really symptoms of a much greater trend, which is our incapacity to forecast an increasingly complex environment. Now, some of that complexity we brought on ourselves, yeah, through globalization and through the increasing impact in technology. But however much people might like to argue about why it is that it is, I think is now reluctantly accepted. Mm. So if your three-legged stool of forecast, plan, execute falls over because one of the legs is broken, what do you do? Mm. And I would say that the organizations and leaders I work with are in a real mess here. Some of them are really trying to pretend that no, it's just we have to do forecasting better. So they're doubling down, mm-hmm, which is a classic response to cognitive dissonance.
Yep.
And some are kind of trying to do things differently, but it's hard to get their heads around. They have armies of people who are used to large degrees of certainty about what's the company going to do, what's my role in the company, what am I going to do. And this just isn't working anymore. And so I would say I see people on the spectrum of being very, very willing to try new stuff and experimenting like mad. Mm. And at the other end of the spectrum, people who are just really thinking we have to be more efficient,
yeah,
even though in complex environments,
yeah,
efficiency is really the last thing you're after.
Yeah.
So I would say that's a very big theme.
Yeah.
And inside that big theme is not in every company, obviously, uh-huh, but I would say a very, very deep reluctance to come to terms with the reality that is climate change,
yeah,
which is it isn't going to kick off in 2050. Mm. It's here now.
Yeah.
And denial, willful blindness around, yeah, that, I think, is profound.
Yeah. And I guess as we're recording this, we are experiencing some of those freak weather conditions across different parts of the globe, and it has displaced people, and it has disrupted life, and it has challenged businesses in response. And you're absolutely right. And you're right to point to your book on willful blindness, because there is something about the fact that, you know, we work under myths, don't we, that we can just get more efficient and it will work out, or AI will save us because it will help us compute faster. And I sense you're absolutely right. This forecasting element to it is such that the uncertainty and the complexity are so abundant now that we've got to change the way we approach things. And I guess you look to leaders sometimes at this point, don't you, to go, well, you know, you're the one in charge. Tell us how it all plays out.
Yes. And I think what's really interesting there, I, you know, mentor senior execs and CEOs mm-hmm. in very, very large global organizations. And what I've seen a lot of over the last 2 years, I would say, is that as some of these senior people, CEOs in particular, are having to deal with the succession issue, and certainly their boards are having to deal with the succession issue, they're really struggling because what they're finding is the CEO is not really up for this radically different environment. It's not the environment in which they grew up or in which they've ever excelled. It's not really their fault, if you like. So that's made succession a much more live issue, probably earlier than it has been in the past. Yep. But what they're also finding is that this senior leadership team or executive committee aren't up for it either, because they all kind of grew up with the same mindset. And so they're having to often skip that level and go a level below to find the kind of open minds, flexible thinking, capacity for innovation and digital understanding that the companies need now. And that's, you know, that's playing havoc with a lot of people's expectations and hopes. And it's proving really, really challenging for boards who, I think, somewhat complacently thought, well, succession is not a problem. We've got an executive committee. They do a great job. There'll be somebody in there who can take over. And they're finding that very often there isn't anybody there.
Certainly my experience in some of that is that there's an almost like Stepford leaders kind of approach. They are kind of replications of what happens. And as you say, when you then look further and deeper, that's when you start to see the more divergent type of thinking and the more innovative and creative sparks and spirit. So I wonder whether we're starting to test ourselves in how we can disperse some of that leadership perhaps and create more of a collective sense rather than the compacted sense that we see. I don't know whether that's a visible thing that you're picking up and sensing and seeing in action.
Well, it's certainly what I see in action in more nimble companies, often younger companies, I would say. And I see it in really excellent leaders. So what I am seeing in companies that I think are doing better in this crisis, because it is a crisis for them, is an openness to say, actually, nobody really knows how to do this. Nobody has been here before. So there is no expertise, right? Yeah. There's nobody you can point to and say, oh, there's old so-and-so over there. He's gone through this. She's gone through this. They'll tell us what to do. Nobody knows. So if nobody knows, first of all, fessing up to that is super helpful, even if it feels or makes you feel a little queasy. Yeah. And secondly, the thing is, okay, well, let's assume we have all sorts of super smart people here. If we convene the right people around the right questions, we can probably figure this out. But that is going to require that we not care about hierarchy. So it can't just be people at, you know, a certain level and above. We have to accept that in complex environments, expertise and experience don't always necessarily hold the key. We have to accept that often the best ideas will come from people working outside their domain expertise. And we have to accept the notion that we're not going to come up with a perfect plan, but we're going to come up with something and then we're going to improve it, rather than coming up with the fantastically detailed, perfectly designed Gantt chart of how we're going to get through the next 100 years. And so I think that takes a huge amount of humility on the part of leaders to recognize that often the power that they have is disruptive in a very negative way. So they have to be either very quiet or step out of the debate because their power means they're going to tilt it too radically. and be very, very open to anything and everything that they hear. It doesn't mean that they abdicate. I think they have to hold the discussion to a standard. I think that's really crucial. Yeah. And put some parameters around it. But I think they need to be wary that in this environment, the power that they represent can be really unhelpful. Mm.
And that is an alien concept that, as you say, their experience has never told them before, and they've never had to question the essence of what it means to lead in that particular sort of scenario. And of course, the business schools aren't teaching that because they haven't kind of caught up with the essence of how this could be created into some kind of simulator or curricula. So it's nice that people can yeah. tap into people like you, and I bet there's a demand element to that, which keeps you incredibly busy, but also in the thick of it, so you can make yeah. some of those judgment calls and help a wider audience.
Yeah.
And
I mean, that's gratifying. I mean, there are many days in which I wish I weren't right, to be honest. Yeah. I wish I were wrong about all this stuff, quite frankly. Yeah. But I think, you know, that part of what I've learned is that the change in habit and the change in ways of thinking yeah. is very, very difficult for a lot of people. Yeah. I mean, I think I hugely underestimated how difficult it is. And in part, I think that's because I really like change. Mm. And I tend to be pretty good at it. And I've made a lot of changes throughout my career. But I think that led me to underestimate the degree to which that isn't how most people have chosen to lead their lives. Yeah. And so at a moment when it's what's needed, it's quite sparse.
Yeah. And
I get a lot of questions from people asking me, for example, how do you get good at change, which is an excellent question. Mm-hmm. And the answer, I think, is you have to do quite a lot of it.
Yeah.
You know, that's how you get good at it. Mm. That's where you discover kind of what your weaknesses are, but also what your strengths are. Mm. I mean, I know that in a crisis, I slow down. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic strength. Mm-hmm. But I may also focus too much.
Yeah.
So, you know, you learn about your capacity to change, I think, only by doing it. But most people, especially I would say in large corporations, who are drawn to work in large corporations, have through thousands of small decisions moved into environments where being good at change isn't what has really been practiced or developed.
Yeah. And it's in the eye of the storm, isn't it? So you are living the experience and learning as you're going through that at the precise
yeah.
time that the thinking space is suddenly challenged by your desire to do and experiment and adapt and adjust. So you can see why people are feeling a little bit of pain, anxiety and questioning their own capability.
Yeah, and I have a lot of compassion for them, to be honest. Mm. I mean, although I get impatient because there's so much to be done and there's so little time, I also have a lot of compassion for the, just for how upset people feel. You know, that this isn't what they were brought up to expect. Yeah. It's not what their education prepared them for. It's not, you know, what their early experience of working life has prepared them for. And so, and they're not failing to grasp the challenge because they're, you know, mad, bad, or difficult. They're struggling. They're really, really struggling. And, you know, you only have to think about raising kids to realize when somebody is struggling, what isn't helpful is to start beating them up.
Yeah, right? For sure.
What is helpful is to remind them of core capacities that are still relevant.
And I want to go back to that word you touched on, which I think is so powerful within this, which is the humility piece. And just how perhaps that hasn't been played strongly up to now, because it's been the I know, I can do, I control, I'm steadying, I am visioning. And now you've got to go, actually, I don't know. I don't have the vision. I doubt my capability. It's a really complete and utter shift, isn't it? And so I agree with you about the compassion side of things.
And it's interesting because I think, I mean, there's an awful lot of guff talked about in business, right? You know, there's all this stuff about, oh, it's so important to be humble. Well, yeah, it is really important to be humble, but it's very difficult to become a CEO saying, I don't know, right? Yeah. There is a huge gravitational pull away from humility. And I think, and I've seen this in CEOs, that the pull to bravura, the pull to confidence that workforces want, that boards want, that shareholders want, often makes these individuals really uncomfortable because it makes them feel like imposters, that they're making greater claims for themselves than they themselves believe. Yeah. So it's even doubly painful when then everybody says, well, you have to be more humble. And you think, but hang on a second. Yeah. I could never have got here being humble. Yeah. And now you suddenly want me to turn around and say, I don't know what I'm doing. I mean, which way is up now? But I think, you know, I wrote in Uncharted about a hospital in Austin, Texas, which is doing a much needed thing, trying to reinvent American healthcare. But one of the things that they said, which I thought was so brilliant when they were designing this hospital and everything they wanted, no architect had ever built before. And they kept saying, well, give us the data that what you want is going to work. And they said, well, there is no data set for the future. There is no data set for a hospital in the United States which has better outcomes by spending less. That's the experiment. And so unless you're prepared to try things and recognizing that many of them won't work, you have to recognize that nobody is an expert in the future. Yeah. It's like saying, well, who knows what kind of house to build on Mars? Nobody knows. Nobody's been there yet.
Yeah. And maybe the humility can channel itself into, I don't know how that is based on what I've done up to now. But what I do know is that if we come together, if we create collective intelligence, if we experiment, if we are front of mind, aware of what's going on, what influences us and what decisions we need to take, there is something assuring in that, isn't there? Almost like a frontier leader, kind of pioneer leader. It's that kind of thing.
Yeah. I think that's a very good phrase for it. And you know, the thing it puts me in mind of is when I was running internet startups in the 90s and early noughties. You know, people said, well, gee, you know, why did you want to do this? Because it's so hard, because it is hard. And I said, well, actually, what excites me about it is there are no footsteps in the sand. You know, nobody's been on this beach before. And therefore, kind of on some level, you can try anything. And I think that's what you've got to do. But the thing that always dazzled me was that with a bunch of great people, we could figure out so much. And so I think what has to go together with the humility is also a deep belief in the capacity of people to come together and figure stuff out.
Yeah.
And also, I would say, a huge pleasure in doing that. About this for 20 years. I've done it for 30 years. And even I am sometimes, well, frequently dazzled that I'll start doing something and somebody will say, well, it'd be better if we did it like this. And somebody else will chuck in another idea. And suddenly we've got something that isn't just any port in a storm. It's actually good. You know, and it's actually inspiring and it energizes people. And now you've got a plan. And it may not be perfect. But you've got the first sentence in the story.
That feels to me like a very nice invitation for those leaders who have been the hero and been the kind of orchestrator of, and are now starting to sense that they could be the creator and the genesis of something different that brings that collective endeavor spirit, and dare I say it, even as you described it, joy of solving something that you looked at before and went, wow, that's novel and I've never seen that before.
And something new can emerge where there was nothing before.
But it does require that sense that the kind of stratification and hierarchy does need to temporarily just displace perhaps in order for people to come into spaces that you as a leader can hold. And I guess the question that you are inviting people to come and answer is pretty crucial, isn't it?
Yeah, and it depends a lot on people knowing each other and trusting each other and not feeling like their whole career is a competition for power and attention. And it's, I think it's one reason why, I mean, it's only one reason why culture has suddenly shot up the corporate agenda. Because actually, if you don't have that sense of give and take and camaraderie, you're just not going to get anywhere because people are going to be too defensive. And it's a habit. You know, there are people who've worked this way their whole lives, and surprise, surprise, they're really good at it and unafraid of it. So it takes quite a lot of practice. And it's interesting because I'm working on a little side project at the moment with some architects getting a rather complicated piece of sculpture installed. And, you know, these are people who do this all the time. And they're such a joy to work with. They're problem solving together all the time because every time they do something, they've never done anything like it before. So they're really accustomed to being out of their depth. And I think that that you know, that means they just have sort of mental muscles, if you like, that those who have a craving for certainty don't develop.
There's something very appealing, isn't there, about the knowing you're out of your depth, but backing yourself to overcome that and even show a sense of brilliance you didn't know you had in you. There's something very appealing to that. You made my my mind go to the whole sense of inclusivity and equity, Margaret, which I know is something very close to your heart and lots of people will know you for. And I do wonder whether this is a bit of a sort of perfect storm where we can say, actually, we've been talking about difference for a long time. Now's the chance to really put it to good use. And now's the time to drop the biases and preconditions and so on and open up more. I don't know. Maybe I'm just being really idealistic there, but I wonder whether we are needing that and therefore we will call that into being perhaps a little bit more inclusion and equity.
Well, I think one generation will. I think it's proving very difficult for older people who regard this as an assault on much that they held dear. You know, and I have some empathy for them because what to some people feels like progress, to other people feels like loss. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that progress, however we care to define it, often requires sacrifice. So if we're going to get to a more diverse and inclusive society, that means that people who are very accustomed to privilege are going to have to sacrifice some of that. And people who are very accustomed to an easier path are going to find it harder. And I think the whole woke debate is kind of fatuous and manipulative. But I do keep thinking, and I don't really know the answer to my own question, though I've been asking it for a very long time. How do we acknowledge the transition in a way that says thank you to people who now are taking less from the pot. You know, the truth is that if there are 12 board seats and we've decided for all kinds of reasons that half of those should go to the other gender, then those who had them in the past, not as many of those people are going to get those board seats. That's just a fact.
Yep.
And I think it's been very fashionable in the diversity community to say, oh, no, this is the tide that raises all boats. That's true eventually. But in the transition, sacrifices have to be made. By the same token, you know, it's all very well to say, oh, when we've dealt with climate change, we'll have this fantastically, infinitely sustainable world and life will be much better. I believe that. But in the meantime, people are going to have to eat less meat. They're going to have to fly less. They're going to have to consume less. And that's going to feel like a real sacrifice to people. I mean, recently I decided I would not do any more long haul flights. And that, you know, I'm American by birth. It means I'm not going to fly to the United States again. And a friend of mine said, oh my God, that's such a sacrifice. And I said, well, yeah, start somewhere. You can't keep thinking it's somehow it's going to happen if it doesn't happen for you. And I don't want to demonize the people who keep doing long haul flying, but I would like to celebrate the people who are eating less meat or no meat. I would like to celebrate the people who are taking trains instead of planes. I think this is really important, and hijacking the woke agenda for vicious purposes, I think is deeply unhelpful, because we need to be able to point to role models that other people can relate to.
Yeah, I like that sentiment, because you're right. The judge and project onto others kind of thing does seem to have really, really kind of captured a destructive sense, when we need to have much more collective views on what we can all do, I guess, as an aggregation to help. So I'm pleased to hear your declaration, and I will definitely follow suit on the flight thing. I gave up meat 4 years ago, so same sort of thing. Yeah, exactly. There are these things we can do that aren't anything other than just the right thing to do.
Hey friends, it's Perry Timms, host of Tomorrow's People. In HR, support is key. Supporting your work, your people, and your organisation. Personio truly gets that. They've got your back with top-notch support in your time zone. Visit personio.com and see how they can support all your HR work. That's P-E-R-S-O-N-I-O.com.
Does bring me back to the whole sense of collective. So if we've looked at leaders and we've agreed that they need some help, and it's great to do so. You covered some of this in a previous book, didn't you? The Bigger Prize, about collaboration and the whole sense of how people come together. Are you seeing a different shape and form of collaboration since COVID, as in there's more desire or it's more a premium? Or I'm just wondering what you're sensing about how we do collaboration now.
Well, I don't think we do it very well. I think that whereas in the early days of the lockdowns, people reached out and looked after each other and did a lot to support each other. And I don't really understand why it happened this way, but I think it did. I think the second year of the pandemic rode back on all of that. And people became more and more isolated and more individualistic. And now I think they're feeling, I mean, they're actively choosing solitude over being in the office, for example. And I think their collaborative muscles have rather wasted. So I feel quite concerned about this for several reasons. First of all, I think it's very bad for society. And also, I think that it's very bad for really creative thinking. But I am very, very struck by the degree to which many of these students that I teach mm-hmm. and young people that I work with find genuine collaboration, negotiation, mediation, virtually impossible. And I don't think the pandemic can take all the blame. Because it's the, you know, it's the go-to culprit for everything. I think that there's a lot about the way that we're educating people and the way that we manage people that has encouraged people to think of themselves as lone wolves. But I feel very, very anxious about the low levels of collaborative capacity I see around me. Now, it definitely doesn't help that certainly in the UK, you know, the government sets an absolutely miserable example. It's a real dog-eat-dog culture. It doesn't help that the political environment globally follows suit. But I don't think I've ever been as pessimistic as I am now about people's capacity to get together and do brilliant stuff together. I think the capacity is still there, but I don't see it happening very often. And I think 18 months or however long it was of people working in their own homes, absolutely disconnected from each other, has had a devastating impact, not just on mental health, but in terms of creative capacity. And however much, you know, and so what I see is a paradox, I think, which is on the one hand, people are thrilled to get together socially. You know, the pubs are buzzing, the restaurants are buzzing, people are going out, you know, the streets are at night are full and busy. But that isn't really what I'm seeing or feeling at work. And that's, I think that's a huge problem. And I think it's a gigantic challenge for people who think of themselves as leaders.
Yeah, and you made me think then about whether we need to be more deliberate about what collaboration gives us and how we can get better at it. And I think it talks to what you said earlier on about the fact that sometimes in order to be good at change, you've just got to do it. So in order to collaborate, we've just got to do it. But it's the stimulus, isn't it? It's the sense of value that comes from it that we probably need to really work on a lot harder than we used to.
Yeah, and I think we have to have a much more explicit and well-informed discussion about it. You know, that that when you stop working at really collaborative working, everything gets so much harder. You know, it just gets so much harder and so much slower and so much less. You know, it's a bit like not oiling the gears. And to make that better requires investing quite a lot of time in creating opportunities for people really to get to know each other, to stop being afraid of having friends at work, for example, to stop being afraid of getting to know each other as people, and to start rebuilding that connectivity, not in terms of just work, but in terms of human to human relatedness. And I can understand why many business leaders think, what the heck am I supposed to be doing? Throwing, you know, tea parties every day? But, you know, you will know with my work, if it's the case that what really makes the difference as far as collective intelligence is concerned is the connection between people, then you better work on that connection between people. Or you can have the smartest people in the building and create nothing with them.
With nothing to bring them together and nothing to coalesce all that lovely intelligence and effort. I'm really with you on that one. And I guess your other trademarks with the technology footprint that you have and the experience that you have. I mean, AI is such a loud noise and everybody's talking about it and bolting it on everywhere. That must be occupying a little bit of your thought now. Do you see AI helping us with collaboration or any of the issues we've said as a very sort of broad frame to think about?
I don't really. I think it's something we're falling back on because our own collaborative ability has waned.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we don't know how to think about it. It's too complex. Yeah. Let the machine decide. Yeah. I think this is super dangerous for two reasons. One is because AI has all sorts of huge difficulties, which we have got to legislate around. Yeah. I mean, there is no industry in the world that isn't subject to regulatory controls. You wouldn't throw a drug out there without testing it. And so I think, you know, this argument about, oh, we can't regulate tech, you know, it'll take all the money out of the cash cow is just ridiculous and absurd. You know, this stuff is as powerful, if not more powerful than a drug. Of course, you've got to regulate it and you've got to be smart enough to figure out how. And if you can't, then you shouldn't do it. I think that part is simple. But I think the other thing, which is, I've heard, you know, some really good people like Stuart Russell occasionally talking about this, though not recently, which alarms me. But which is this, you know, this thing, the tech paradox, which is where you choose to use technology, the skills that technology replaces, you lose those skills in yourself. Yeah. So, you know, and the really banal illustration of this is I don't know my children's phone numbers. Mm-hmm. I have outsourced to my phone the job of remembering that. Now, I don't really mind that because if I lose my phone, well, I have my husband, I have email, I have all sorts. I have a lot of redundancy built into my system for contacting my children. But if you take it to almost slightly more complex things, if I don't really know how to write, so I just accept, you know, the suggestions that Word or predictive texting sends to me, then I start to lose the ability to think because choosing words, writing is about thinking and thinking about what exactly is it I want to say. And if I think, oh, sod it, I'll just use what I'm offered. You do that enough, you forget, you lose the capacity to express your own ideas. If you use predictive texting to fill in your terms of endearment, you know, you lose the capacity to have your own feelings. And the consequences of this are really very frightening. I mean, there's, you know, I've written also about some stupid parenting app, which attracted hundreds of millions of dollars of investment, you know, which essentially taught you how to speak to your children. Well, of course, the consequence of that was people were spending more time talking to the app than talking to their children, right? I mean, this is madness. It's absolutely madness. And I think we have to be really clear that if you're going to outsource decision-making to a machine, you are going to learn lose your ability to tell a good decision from a bad decision. And at that point, you've lost all of your sense of agency.
There's a real responsibility on us individually, isn't there, to counsel ourselves on that. Like you said, there's convenience and memory retention. And then there are absolutely integral connectivity skills that if we're not careful, we will suddenly exasperate perhaps that isolation that you talked about earlier on, because we're just outsourcing things. You're right about the salutation to a loved one. If you kind of just use that in auto text, that's like, because it came that way, did you really mean it or not? I mean, it's a real existential question.
Yeah, exactly. And if I get one more email from someone that starts, I hope you're well, you know, I'll scream. I probably already screamed. It's like, it doesn't mean anything. I don't know if you wrote it because everybody else is writing it or because a machine wrote it. But actually, you know, I don't care if you hope I'm well. Just tell me what you need to tell me. Or, you know, say, oh, I hope you're having a great summer. I'm off in Spain and I had this wonderful time, which we can have a conversation about our wonderful holidays. Yeah. But this, you know, I'm really struck by how formulaic people's language has become. Yeah. And, you know, and it's perfectly possible to lose this ability to articulate.
And I think you're right when we think about how words make us feel, when there is that sense of celebration and appreciation that you know somebody has either handwritten or has taken the time to think about how they type it to you. It makes you feel something, doesn't it? Yeah. It really does, yeah.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. Mm. And I think, you know, you quite rightly talked about the allure of convenience. Mm. I thought about this a lot because this is always, I mean, Silicon Valley propaganda does two things. It talks about convenience mm-hmm. as the ultimate goal. Yeah. And it also always introduces new technology as with a cover story, which is, oh, but this is going to help the disabled. Mm. Always, you know, driverless cars, we're going to allow blind people to get around and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's all terrible, terrible hoax. Mm. But, you know, if you think about convenience, there's a sort of a pipe dream that Alex Pentland once outlined, you know, that you'd be standing on a street corner waiting for a bus that you knew was going to arrive because it was already scheduled to take you to the hospital appointment, which was already predicted for you to have the treatment for the disease that was already predicted and get the treatment that it's already predicted will work. Mm. And he goes on through this kind of whole day. And it's a kind of daydream of everything working perfectly. Mm. And you think, you know, on the day that you're waiting for the bus, it doesn't come. Of course, this is very appealing. Mm. But I remember thinking, okay, so what if that's my whole life? Mm. What if everything is perfect. Mm. You know, everything happens on time, the right way, and so on. I'm just a passenger. Mm.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, what is the point of my life at all? Mm. You know, if you talk to people about their holidays, what is it they tend to talk about? Mm. They talk about the surprises, the things they discovered they didn't know they were going to meet, or the people they met that they didn't know they were going to meet, or the cute little restaurant they found that isn't anywhere on TripAdvisor. Mm. You know, it's the surprises that make life interesting. Mm. And the things and the scrapes that we find our way out of. Yeah. But just being, you know, I mean, Alex Pentland's idea of heaven feels to me like the experience that an Amazon parcel has on an assembly line.
Mm. Yeah.
So I just start thinking this convenience thing, it's a pretty miserable definition of satisfaction. Mm. You hear, imagine at the end of, you know, when you're being buried, you know, the great thing about Margaret's life is that everything was so convenient.
Yeah.
Really? Mm. Seriously?
Yeah. Not much of a eulogy, that, is it? No.
And not much of a eulogy, not much of a life. No. Everything worked like clockwork.
Yeah. There's something lovely, isn't there, about, like you said, our ability to roll with imperfections and have those surprises and unexpected things. The sort of the script of life is not what we want it to be set out. It's discovery. It's highs and lows. It's it's why music is a range of notes, I guess, as it is. It's the joy we get from assembling them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very nice.
And as you say, discovery.
Mm. Yeah, nice. So thank you, Margaret. As we kind of come to an end, is there one thing that you want to leave our listeners with that you are really excited about, that you really would love to share, and some kind of top tips and so on? I'll put some notes in about how they can follow you and find you if they haven't come across you already. But yeah, anything that's really given you a sense of like inner excitement and drive and buzz?
Well, I'm pretty excited at the notion that people have suddenly decided that they don't want to work 100 hours a week. Mm. I think this is a great thing. Okay. You know, I've written a great deal about the impact of overwork on people's ability to think, and especially to think ethically. Mm. And I am thrilled to bits that it is now acceptable for people to say, I'm on holiday and I'm not going to reply to email. Yeah. Or, yes, I could do that, but actually my plate's full this week, so I'll have to do it next week. That kind of pushback, which used to feel impossible, it seems to me now is really pretty normal. Yeah. And I think it's great because, you know, the brain is the piece of machinery we use for thinking, and we have abused it mightily, thinking we can all be masters and mistresses of the universe. Mm. And so the recognition that this is bad for people and leads to bad decision making, I think that's absolutely fantastic. Mm. I think, you know, I think the, however grudging it may feel sometimes, I think the leaps that we've made as far as especially ethnic diversity is concerned is really absolutely fantastic. So those are things which, you know, my parents would never have believed possible at all. And I think which I would not have believed possible, you know, when I was a teenager. Yeah. So I think those things are really, really positive. I think the technological advances in the face of the climate change are fantastic. But I'm also dismayed by the degree to which actually the innovation we need on that front is political innovation. Yeah. I think the technological problems are in our grasp, but our political habits and institutions are now so old-fashioned that they can't cope. Yeah. But I do think there's an awful lot of just absolutely inspiring technological thinking about how we deal with the climate crisis, which gives me a lot of hope. And beyond that, I don't know. I think it's a very difficult time. It's the most difficult time I can remember living through, and I think that for me, what's important in terms of keeping one's spirits up in the light of some really daunting problems is definitely the collaborations that I have with colleagues that I love. The fact that most of my students really just want to do something that's good for the world. They're, you know, when I first started teaching, they just all wanted to go off and make their millions. And now they want to go off and do something that's good. That, I think, is just thrilling.
Lovely. I'm picking up from that that there's a sort of nobleness that we are starting to see, and the ability to say no. And I think there's something very powerful in that. Well, Margaret, thank you. That was every bit as immersive, and I'm kind of now thinking I can't wait to watch it back because there's so much wisdom in that. but you always give this real sense of reality, but also a sense of what we can do about it. So I absolutely hope that that continues for many more years in terms of the teaching and the writing and the stuff that you do. But thank you again for being part of this podcast and helping us help tomorrow's people. So thanks very much, Margaret.
Well, thanks for your interest in my work, and good luck to everybody who's listening.
Thank you. If you've enjoyed this episode of Tomorrow's People, please subscribe and check out our previous episodes from wherever you get your podcasts from. And if you want to transform your people processes, head to personio.com.